No one can sour a wedding like a liquored up prodigal father of the bride. The engaged couple warned me that the absentee father might show up, and if he shows up, he's probably going to be drunk and would probably cause trouble, as he always does when he's drinking. Having had a similar experience before, when a family member had to be escorted from a funeral, I didn't want that to happen to this couple at their wedding. So I assure the couple, particularly the bride, not to worry, that if the father showed up and he was drunk, I would take care of it. So, 5 minutes before the wedding procession began, in staggered a drunk father of the bride. I was hoping for a sober father. The maid of honor came to me and told me that he was there and that he was intoxicated. And by this time, I'm in my robe and in my stole, ready to process into the sanctuary with the groom and the groomsmen. So I walked into the rear of the sanctuary without him seeing me. He was easy to find. He was a slight man in a suit from 3 different Easters, unlit cigarette between his fingers, waving his arms around and being raw and loud and inappropriate. And I walked down the side aisle to the pew and sat down beside him and put my arm around his shoulders and pulled him real close to me. He froze. His head facing the front of the sanctuary, he knew he was busted. And I said to him, "I'm really glad that you came to your daughter's wedding. There's not going to be a problem during this wedding ceremony, is there?" And he shook his head no, and he said, no, Father. And after a bit, and without saying anything else, I stood up and began the wedding procession, and the wedding came off without a hitch. Go ahead, you can call me a bully. You know, Jesus could throw a wrench into a fine religious function too. Nobody could ruin a Pharisee's gathering like the eccentric Jesus. 3 times in Luke's gospel, Pharisees invite Jesus to their homes, and every time the event sours a bit. At one gathering, Jesus ignores the ritual purity of washing before meal. And instead of apologizing for the oversight, Jesus thunders 6 woes to the Pharisees present, condemning them for their own impurity. And at another dinner hosted by a Pharisee, Jesus rebukes his host for judging another, judging a woman who wipes and kisses his feet. The nerve of Jesus, invited by one of the chosen few for a dinner party, only to offend him in his own house. And now at the home of a prominent Pharisee, Jesus is present as presence attracts tax collectors and other sinners, riffraff. Riffraff who were infiltrating the neighborhood, and once again, the party begins to sour when they see Jesus welcoming and dining with undesirables. Overhearing the irate grumbles of the Pharisees, Jesus responds this time not with woes and rebukes, but a trilogy of parables, all of them with the same plot. Something is lost, that something is found, and to celebrate the finding, a party. Now, these are good stories, 3 back-to-back stories that remind us that God's talent for finding us is greater than our talent for getting lost. The first 2 parables seem like introduction stories to the story of the prodigal son and his brother. Perhaps the biggest reason that people like the final story, the prodigal son, the best is that the subject is a lost person. Why would Jesus even begin with stories whose lost characters are a sheep and a coin? Why not just go right straight into the story of the wayward son or sons? Maybe he begins with these non-human characters because Jesus' listeners see the sinners with whom Jesus dines and less than human. Maybe Jesus is stepping into that self-righteous level from where the Pharisees look down upon those lowlifes who are souring the party. Why not use a sheep and or a coin as metaphors for these second-rate souls? Now, before we judge these Pharisees too harshly, let's cut them a little slack. It wouldn't be out of the question for them to connect with the sheep story for other reasons. Because the man in that parable is at least somewhat well-to-do. He's not a lowly shepherd. Rather, he is the owner of the sheep, and he owns 100 of them. One sheep goes astray, gets separated from the flock, and the sheep owner leaves the other 99 to go out and to find the one. And a Pharisee might be thinking to himself as he listens to this story, well, of course he goes out to find that sheep. That's his livelihood. This is inventory. And while the sheep is not gold and frankincense, they're not cheap either. And it's almost certain that this businessman had hired help to watch the other 99 in the open field. Good for him, concludes the Pharisee. Good for him being assertive and diligent enough to hunt down that lost sheep. Sounds like a resourceful fella. You know, I could see us making a stop by this man's celebration party. We don't need to stay too long. We would just drop by, bless his house, and make an early exit. So sorry we can't stay. We need to get back to our duties at the temple. I wonder if they even get what Jesus means when he concludes that there will be more rejoicing in heaven over a repentant sinner than over 99 righteous persons who don't need to repent. I wonder if we do. And then Jesus moves on to the second story about a coin. But this parable had to be a bit more difficult for the Pharisees to appreciate. Of the three parties, the three lost and found celebrations at the end of each parable, this would be the party least likely for the Pharisees to attend because the person in this story is a lowly woman. She is a poor village peasant living in a house with no windows. Remember, she has to light a lamp to search for her coin. The picture is of someone of lower class than the sheep owner, for even the coin that she loses speaks to her being in a lower class. The missing coin may be a part of the family savings, but if so, it's not a great sum. It's the equivalent of about 10 days' wages at the very best. And when compared to a sheep and a son, the coin has the least value. But it is of great value to this poor woman, and she searches carefully until she finds it. And to celebrate her finding it, she invites her friends to come and help her rejoice that the missing coin was found. But do you think Jesus' listeners, the Pharisees, would attend her party? Probably not. The bash is hosted by a woman. And we don't know whether this woman is married. She might be alone for some scandalous reason. She might be a single mother. If nothing else, she's poor. And she's perceived as cursed. Go to her party? Likely it's a unanimous no among the Pharisees. Best stay away from that one, and there's really no point. Need not be seen in her presence with her people and stain our good reputation and appearance. I wonder if they hear Jesus say that the angels rejoice with her. I wonder if we do. How often do we keep others at arm's length based on our perceptions of them? It seems that by categorizing other people, it gives us a false sense of power over them and a false sense of superiority. And by having power over them, we can deal with them or we can ignore others as we please. While I know it happens all the time, I don't think we have any power to judge and determine another's place in the world. In God's kingdom, we don't have the power to give a thumbs up or a thumbs down, nor do we have a scale by which we judge another's worth. Indeed, our own worth as kingdom dwellers is found in giving up any power and treating others as if they were Jesus. The true reflection of our relationship with Jesus is seen in our relationship with others. A relationship with Jesus creates space at the table for the very least of these. A relationship with Jesus gives voice to those who have a lesser voice in the social order of things. Our lives with Jesus give ourselves over to the people who are like sheep have gone astray and whose cries are regarded less than others' pleas. Our lives with Jesus give ourselves over to the people whose plight gives them no voice at all, as if they were no more than a forgotten coin. The pastor of a larger downtown church tells a story about Donnie. It was one of those meet and greet coffee and cookie receptions for prospective members into which Donnie staggered. Ordinarily, Donnie would wander in before the worship service asking for a few dollars. This time, his arrival was after worship. Prospective members tried hard not to appear offended. Often Donnie wandered away for long periods of time for the church, and then he'd find his way back to the church, and there he would be found by those who watched for him and who understood him. He knew that among those sinners there was always a place for him at the table. It was a bit awkward, though, on that day. He stumbled into the room with a new guest and potential new members of the church. A middle-aged woman in nicely coiffed hair and a pearl necklace made a nervous attempt to have a conversation with Donnie. "Donnie, this is such a beautiful old church, especially the sanctuary. What's your favorite part of the church?" Donnie looked at her with hazy and glassy eyes and responded, "Hey, I don't play favorites. I love all of you." No one was really quite sure what he meant, and most assumed that his words were filtering through a drunk fog. "Oh," the woman attempted to clarify, "I mean the sanctuary where we worship." "Oh," said Donnie with a crooked grin, "well, I mean the sanctuary that you give me. I don't play favorites. I love all of you." I don't know if the Donnie in this story was sober when he said that, but if we listen to what he says, his words have a sobering effect. Are we the sanctuaries whom Jesus calls us to be? Do we love fellow sinners as freely as Donnie does? Will we make room at the table for all sinners and outcasts? will we do so for those most dehumanized, for those who have little or no voice? Will we welcome sheep of all varieties? Will we seek and find coins of all currencies? I wonder if we hear Jesus say that even angels rejoice. A pastor in England wanted to set up a ministry in the nightclub scene of Newcastle. He decided that he would first visit the nightclubs of the town, a whole group of which were located in one area very close to the train station. In each of these nightclubs, there was a wild scene of intense music, flashing strobe lights and bodies vibrating to music. The fourth nightclub he visited seemed to be a replica of the previous thing, of the previous three, except for one thing. Sitting off in the corner was a middle-aged man wearing a tweed jacket and tie. If ever there was a person out of place, this man fit the bill. And the pastor went over to him and in a tone of amazement asked, "What in the world are you doing here?" And the man responded, "2 months ago, I had an argument with my daughter. She'd gotten into a bad crowd, changed her total appearance. She was doing things she shouldn't be doing, and she stayed out all night, time and time again. We had many, many arguments, and one day a few weeks ago, she stormed out of the house, she slammed the door, and she yelled that she was never coming back again. I know that she hangs out at places like this, so every Friday and Saturday night, I come to this part of Newcastle to sit in a nightclub and hope that I will see her. I want to put my arms around her and tell her that I love her and that any time that she wants to come home, she will be more than welcome because I miss her so very, very much. Count on it. There is more joy in heaven over one rescued life than over 99 people who need no rescue." Jesus searches for us. The good news is that there is a place at Christ's table for the dullest of Pharisees and, yes, the dirtiest of sinners. There is room for the most lost sheep and the most hidden of coins. There's room for the wandering soul, and there's room for you and me. Remember the words to the old hymn, "Come home, come home. You who are weary, come home. Earnestly, tenderly, Jesus is calling, come home." And always, always, there is rejoicing. Amen.